Now, I'm coming to you folks right now from GPB's Macon Studios, as I always do. Macon is an especially beautiful place to be this week for our International Cherry Blossom Festival. While Washington, D.C. is known for its Cherry Blossom Festival, some people call Macon the cherry blossom capital of the world. And in fact, we get visitors from all over the world this time of year, which is remarkable for several reasons, among them being the fact that the Yoshino cherry tree does not grow very well here. Believe me, I've got one in my backyard. Arborist Derek Catlett joins us to discuss the science and the history of raising these trees in this climate. Welcome back, Derek.
Hello, hello, Adam. Thank you.
So why does D.C. get all the press? I think we have more trees in Macon.
So, you know, it's just D.C. is where it all naturally began in 1912. So they're naturally going to be the forefront of the events.
What do you say? What do you mean by that? It all began in 1912.
So in 1912, over 1,800 cherry trees were given to the mayor of D.C. from the mayor of Tokyo. And they, over the following 8 years, they did mass planting projects to blanket the city.
Okay. Is that how eventually a tree made its way down to Macon?
We would all like to know how that wonderful tree was in Mr. Bill Fickling's backyard in 1949 when he found this oddity of a rare tree in his backyard. No one in town could really even identify the tree.
Bill Fickling, a well-known Macon business magnate. And it's the particular tree that we have in great numbers down here is the Yoshino cherry tree. What does that look like?
Pretty typical of the cherry species, you know, broad spreading light pink blossoms.
And Bill Fickling liked them quite a lot and just sort of said, hey, let's all plant Yoshino cherry trees in our yards.
Man, that tree fascinated him. He stared at it for 3 years, and it wasn't until 1952 when he actually visited D.C. himself that he walked that tidal basin and went, hey, this is the same tree that nobody could identify in my backyard.
Huh.
So then he came back to Macon once he knew the tree, and he began propagating it, giving it away freely to everyone in town who would take one.
Right, and his property up in North Macon is still sort of the epicenter, other than downtown, of the festival. Everybody goes up to see those, you know, big old fields there covered in those white flowers. And as you said, when right before the flower opens up into its full flower, when it's just a little blossom, it's pink, and it's sort of an interesting transition for it to go from pink to white. It's very, very pretty. However, this is not a tree that does terribly well in our climate.
Yeah, you know, in the right conditions, like on Mr. Fickling's private property, there are trees that were planted somewhere in the 50s to early 70s that are still alive and thriving today. But then you look on our roadsides where we plant them in this beautiful Georgia red clay, and you get the amplified heat effect from the asphalt, and they really do struggle.
Okay, yeah, they need a nice hard freeze in the winter too in order to be at their best. Last couple of years, the one that I've had in my backyard just gave me no flowers at all in the springtime. Now, we did have a nice cold winter this year, which is why I'm sort of surprised that we're not having as big of a bloom for this year's festival as we normally do. I mean, it's okay, but it's not our best. What's going on?
Man, this winter we were geared up with very spectacular expectations, but then I'm afraid that I believe the late freeze we had just a few weeks back really set them back drastically.
Yeah. Is there anything we can do about that?
You know, after the fact, there's not a whole lot you can do. If you had a prize tree right at your front door, you might would try to put a blanket or a tarp over it or even some little clip-on heat lamps.
Right.
If the buds are already starting to swell and we get that late freeze, you try to protect them in any way you can.
But you've got a master plan that you want to try out to see if you can get Macon's trees to bloom just in time for the festival.
Yeah, one of my more recent thoughts are I believe the soil temperature has a lot to do with the bloom period as far as when they open in full force.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wanting to take a block and maybe water them with light warm water for 2 or 3 weeks before the festival.
Right.
And see if that forces them to blossom any earlier than the ones out in the open areas.
All right. If anyone is looking to fund a pilot project, Derek Catlett is here ready and willing to give it a shot. It's funny when we talk about like introducing non-native ornamental plant species to environments, which is a big issue here in Georgia. Normally, what we're talking about is things that we're worried are going to propagate and just take over and crowd out all of the native species. You know, like the English ivy and the kudzu and all those things that are just, you know, people put in their gardens and it's just taking over the whole environment. This is another kind of problem with a non-native species, which is that they're just sort of permanently sickly here.
Yeah, it takes takes a different type of soil. Cherry trees in general want a real healthy, organic, rich soil that drains really well, yet retains moisture. So we're talking about Georgia red clay that turns to bricks in the summer and has absolutely zero nutritional value in that soil.
Is there a better option for people who are wanting to have a big spring show in their yards, but maybe they want to go with something that's a little bit more native?
Yes, if you want to avoid amending your whole site, be it your whole front yard, so these cherry trees really take off well and thrive for you.
When you say amending, you mean putting in new soil?
Well, you would add organic material to the existing soil, so it's more about adding manure and compost and tilling it in to a depth of about 8 inches. Which can be costly when you're talking about doing a quarter acre front yard.
Yeah, so say I don't want to do that. What's a better option?
I always tell people to go to your local state parks, like the Indian Mounds, walk around, and you'll notice these beautiful red buds and dogwoods flowering. And one less used plant's a hawthorn, and there's many, many species of hawthorns native to Georgia that also put on a spectacular springtime bloom.
Well, nonetheless, we do have a number of reasonably healthy Yoshino cherry trees to be ogled here in Macon for the time being. So, folks, come on down for the International Cherry Blossom Festival, which continues through this coming weekend. And we were just speaking there with Derek Catlett. He's an arborist here in Macon. You can find more information about the Cherry Blossom Festival and its history at gpbnews.org. Derek, thank you much.
Thank you, Adam.
White, Georgia is about 45 minutes northwest of Atlanta, and it is home to a massive junkyard for rare and retired vehicles. On Second Thought, producer Sean Powers drove up to Old Car City, USA, and sent us back this audio postcard.
Well, it's Old Car City, Old Car City, USA.
My name is Dean Lewis. I've been to this place all my life. My mother and daddy started in 1931 with the general store. A few years later, I was born, and I grew up in it. I went off and got a job later, came back in about 1970 and added about 4,000 cars to my collection, and it became Old Car City.
50 miles all over Atlanta, Highway 411 USA, and here in Georgia.
Most of the junk boys or salvage yard or whatever, they sold. They sell as scrap and make more room and all. We luckily, we had enough room to save them, didn't have to sell them. And in fact, at one point several years ago, I was out of room, so I went and bought 26 adjoining acres so that I wouldn't have to crush.
It's a rare old car. Let's go around this way. I want to show you a couple more things. My name's Rocky. Every day I find something new. 6 miles of trails and nothing but art and nature and old cars. We've got a few cars in here that people don't even know really existed. We've got a 1929 Singer. There wasn't that many of them. When you're walking through here, you'd be thinking about the stories some of them could tell you. How many times people took off across the country, how far they went with them. Kind of like the pioneers, Clark and Luke, Lewis and Clark. Now here's an old veteran. I met him earlier.
Hey, lots of cars. How many cars he got in here?
A little over 4,000.
4,000,
wow.
Ron Swope, lived in Ringgold, Georgia. Never stopped here before. My son,
Mark. Read about it in the Chattanooga paper. I live in Chattanooga. My name is Mark Swope. I know a lot about old cars, so it's just kind of interesting looking at all the old cars, like the design of them and all the chrome and all that.
Yeah, some of them we had, some of them we drove, some of them we was around when we were kids.
My name's Pam Clayton. I'm from Live Oak, Florida. My first car was an old Pinto. Saw one of those. My husband here, we were dating, he fixed it up and painted it, and we actually took it to the Netherlands and had it there for 3 years, and we actually left it there. So there's a Ford Pinto in the Netherlands.
My name is Marco, last name's Rossi, and I'm a photographer. I've found the first car that I bought 4 different times out here. I don't know if I can say this, I found the automobile I lost my virginity in. The first car I bought was a 1970 Grand Am. What I lost the virginity in was a 78 Caprice, a classic that was my father's car.
My name is Daniel Scott and we're from Marietta, Georgia. No, my name is Katie Scott, and I'm from Marietta, Georgia as well. It was crazy because we were talking about how my grandmother loves cars like this, and she actually still drives like the more modern versions of these same old cars, and it was just amazing to think that back in the day, these are the kind of vehicles that she used to drive around, and she loves to talk about them and everything that she used to have, and we've been trying to find things that she used to have to take pictures of to show her, and it's been amazing.
50 miles all over Atlanta, Highway 411, USA, down here in Georgia. Old Car City.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. March is Women's History Month, and we're taking the month to recognize the contributions of many Georgia women to the history of the state. Civil rights icon Rosalind Pope is a woman who made some of that history. She wrote an appeal for human rights in 1960 when she returned to America after a year-long scholarship in Paris. This document was the heartbeat of the Atlanta student movement, which sought to end segregation. Rosalind Pope was appointed as president of the student government at Spelman College in Atlanta. That's where her activism started, on the campus of Atlanta University. On Second Thought, producer Fenley Foxen met with Rosalind Pope.
Rosalind Pope was the main driver of the Atlanta student movement with her document, An Appeal for Human Rights, in the 1960s. Here is an excerpt from the document. "We do not intend to wait placidly for those rights, which are already legally and morally ours, to be meted out to us at a time. Today's youth will not sit by submissively while being denied all of the rights, privileges, and joys of life." I wanted to interview Rosalind Pope because I wanted to know her thinking behind the document. Well, here's Rosalind Pope.
Four students at North Carolina A&T College in Greensboro had made the daring move of sitting in at a restaurant to get coffee and pie, which they were not allowed to do. The Jim Crow laws said that black people did not eat along with white people. So in terms of Jim Crow, it was illegal. But they had made that move, and that's what kicked off the student movement in 1960, was that daring move of those four students. So since I had been in Paris the previous year and had had a wonderful taste of freedom, I had not encountered any place that I couldn't go, any place I couldn't eat or listen to music or study or go to the library. You know, even the libraries, the public libraries, were segregated during this period. So everything was a no to us. But I had been to Paris and I had had nothing but yeses for a whole year. Lonnie King had been in the Navy. And so even though the services were somewhat segregated, they were more integrated than the rest of society because they were government installations. So he also had that taste of freedom.
Let's talk about your document, An Appeal for Human Rights. Explain to me your thinking process when you wrote that document.
Well, I think I was glad to have an opportunity. The six presidents of the colleges making up the University Center, they called together three students from each college to come and talk about what they had heard on the grapevine, that students were planning to make a move. They were planning to go downtown and picket and sit in, that we were going to follow what Greensboro had done. And they were not happy about it. And so efforts were made in this meeting of 18 people, which came to be known as the Committee on the Appeal for Human Rights. And since it fell upon me, because the committee didn't work very well that we thought could put it together. So at the last minute, before it was due, I started and wrote through the day and the night. And we got it together just before it was due. And I was glad to be able to have an opportunity to say the things that are mentioned in the appeal.
your journey started with the Appeals for Human Rights. It's a document that's going to go down in history. Ms. Rosalind, what does that feel like to know that you were part of such a momentous, such a great movement?
I could not have imagined it at the time. You know, we were trying to get our walking papers to take to the streets, and it was in that spirit, though as I wrote it, I realized how important it was to me that I was writing it. I didn't know that it would be taught in different classrooms all over the country and even in other countries. And so it's gratifying. It feels good to have made a contribution. I'll put it that way.
Ms. Rosalind Pope, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Finley. I enjoyed meeting you and talking with you.
That was Rosalind Pope, civil rights activist, speaking with On Second Thought producer Fenley Foxon. Well, it's been another long week, so as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened. It's time for the break room.
If you break the law and illegally peddle these deadly poisons, we will find you, we will arrest you.
This was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened. You know, we have a basic responsibility to protect people's data.
How about a round of applause? Yeah. Standing ovation.
Ooh, oh, yeah. That last one will make sense in a few minutes here. Joining us in the break room is Kalina Bowler, host of the Credits podcast. Welcome back, Kalina.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me.
With us, former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning.
Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez is back. Hello, Hector.
Hello. Good morning, everybody.
And with us also is Ed Sohn, vice president of product management at Thomson Reuters Legal. Welcome back, Ed.
How's it going?
So let's get right into it here. President Trump is calling for the death penalty for drug traffickers. He suggests that it could curb the opioid crisis, which is certainly ravaging Georgia in particular. More recently, we've got Attorney General Jeff Sessions sending out a memo to federal prosecutors specifying this guidance, urging them to seek the death penalty only in large-scale drug trafficking cases or in drug trafficking cases that have involved murder. Is it reasonable, folks, to think that such a threat would be a deterrent to drug kingpins? What do you think, Kathy?
There are so many studies, including a recent one, that shows that it doesn't work, that prohibiting drugs and also having the death penalty, I covered the death penalty for many years, doesn't stop people from doing crimes. So,
let alone major drug trafficking, right?
Yeah,
I imagine
right.
That the people who do these things live under threat of death all the time.
So it doesn't appear to me that that would make any difference.
Any dissenting opinion on the panel?
Not really. I'm Colombian. I should know about this. I mean, this makes no sense at all. I mean, besides, just when we're moving in the opposite direction towards decriminalizing drugs and overall society's thinking is beginning to come to terms with the fact that we've waged a war that has been nonsensical for God knows how many decades, this guy's want to move in the opposite direction. I think the guy's senile.
Well, yeah, but I mean, decriminalizing individual small-scale possession is an entirely different thing from the war against international organized crime rings that move this stuff around and hurt a
really?
Lot of people in the process, right? Don't you think?
No, I think it's all correlated. I mean, I lived, you know, when I was in college, I was in the middle of the drug war in Colombia. And I mean, all that was happening over there was fed by the immense flow of cash from people purchasing, you know, drugs left and right, you know, even the occasional user or whatever. In the end, it all builds up.
Right.
I don't have a dissenting opinion on this. However, I can understand why people who aren't, well up on this topic would think that this is a deterrent, but it's not. Opioids in particular have a lot more to do with mental, physical health issues. And it's not so much that people are trying to purposefully abuse these things. They're highly addictive drugs. And so if we make this a public health issue more than anything, I think we're going to start seeing a major difference in this issue.
But the question is, where do you get the money for that? And it is a public health issue.
Right.
I mean, Pax.
You tax the drugs.
I would say that.
There you go. Decriminalize, yeah, and tax them.
You know, the other sort of objective issue that I have with this, other than everything that's been mentioned, is just that, you know, penalties and criminal punishment and sentencing is something that is a nuanced art. It's not something that you can just say, well, for this thing, because of, you know, the political promises that I've made during a campaign, I'm going to take a disproportional perspective. I mean, if you say that, you know, the death penalty for drug dealers, what else should get the death penalty?
Exactly.
Like, what else, you know, what else is in the line that should have received similar treatment?
And the Supreme Court weighs in on that from time to time. And also, there are 61, I believe, federal prisoners on death row convicted of drug-related murders, which are, you know, gets the death penalty. There we go. But the last federal execution was 15 years ago. Mm. So the federal government has not been even carrying out executions on the people that are already convicted of drug murder-related murders.
And to go back to the point that I'm kind of obsessed with, you got to imagine that the manner of death penalty that a drug kingpin would experience at the federal death row in Terre Haute would be considerably more mild than the death that he might encounter at the hands of one of his competitors or colleagues. But moving on, a 13-year-old Georgia boy.
All right. Woo. They're all psychopaths, Adam.
Indeed. Well, who knows? A 13-year-old Georgia boy faces charges of making terroristic threats. Authorities say that he left menacing racist messages on the Cobb County NAACP's voicemail. Quote, "My name, Johnny Rebel. My profession, murdering black people." End quote. The police have not released this boy's name because, again, he is 13. Prosecutors have said that they intend to try him as a juvenile in court. Does that seem like the right response to you, Kalina?
Yes. Yeah, that's fine. He's just young enough to still be able to understand that there are consequences to his actions and to possibly be able to turn his life around. And he is so young, so being tried as a juvenile is totally fine, in my opinion. He should get some sort of, I think he should, his prosecution should be kind of harsh in a way to, you know, trying to deter him or people like him or other teenagers like him from doing something like this. But I don't think he should, you know, we should pursue anything where he's tried as an adult or anything.
What do you think, Ed?
Yeah, I tend to agree. At the end of the day, the reason why we treat juveniles differently than adults is because we don't think that they exercise the fully formed judgment of adults. In no way is that letting him off the hook. And I totally agree that from a societal perspective, we have to take a hardline stance on this type of thing. You know, terroristic threats also is a very wide-ranging offense that, you know, if somebody screams at somebody else, "I'm going to kill you," and, like, picks up a knife, that's one thing. If somebody leaves a phone call like this, I mean, it spans so broadly. So I think that gives us a lot of discretion to treat it accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We'll leave that one there. It's been a bad week for social media. Facebook co-founder Mark Zuckerberg apologized on CNN for the Cambridge Analytica scandal. This is the data mining firm that was able to get the personal data of 50 million Facebook users and use it to target ads at them supporting Donald Trump's presidential campaign. Facebook knew years ago that the company had gotten this data, and they did hardly anything about it. Let's listen to Zuck on CNN.
Our responsibility now is to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And there are a few basic things that I think we need to do to ensure that. One is making sure that developers like Alexander Kogan, who got access to a lot of information and then improperly used it, just don't get access to as much information going forward.
Facebook stock has plummeted. Tens of millions of subscribers say they want out. Are any of you thinking about deleting your Facebooks in your Faces book in protest, Hector?
I am. I already requested a full download of everything I have there in our archive. And I already have a scheduling account. I hardly use it anymore. But then again, we're dinosaurs. I mean, the young crowd, they don't even use Facebook anymore. So I think this definitely is going to hurt them.
It's true. I noticed this among my students here at Mercer University. I teach a social media-oriented class, and I always ask them what they're using. And they all have Facebook accounts, but none of them use it as their primary mode of expression. I do wonder if they might age into Facebook as they get a little bit older and start to need to use social media for the things that us olds use it for, like professional networking and things like that. But that might be one thing. I mean, this might be one reason for them to not do that. Kathy, are you thinking about ditching Facebook?
I haven't been using it very much. I actually use Twitter more. And so I don't think I'm going to ditch it. I am looking into my settings for the first time. It's like, oh, maybe I need to check my settings. But I just think it's a ridiculous situation that he's saying, Zuckerberg is now saying, oh, we're going to make these changes. They don't know how to do this. They don't know how to stop companies from getting our information. And I think if you're on Facebook, you're going to realize, I don't take those quizzes, by the way, but I think you're going to realize that your information is out there.
We should clarify that Cambridge Analytica first got this data. Their entree was by inviting people to take one of those fun little personality quizzes on Facebook. And in doing so, you agree to to turn over some of your data. Amanda Respis, who's a professor at Georgia College, tweets at us, I love these posts about how to protect your Facebook data. It's naive to think that this is not what we voluntarily for free have signed up for. Mm-hmm. Facebook, Google, etc., they all own us and they own our data.
Yeah.
Ed,
yeah.
You think that's about right?
Yes. And I think that we all know that, I mean, whether we knew it or not, to what extent, I think people all knew that our data was being mined for political purposes.
Well, and let me just say this. You know, I work a lot in terms of cross-border data, and especially as evidence in litigation, and there's policies around that. And the thing is, in the EU, it's a dramatically different environment when it comes to mm-hmm. data protection. And I always marvel at this idea that in the United States, and I'm totally speaking to myself here, I am an avid user of social media, but we regularly trade in our privacy for functionality. We regularly say, you can totally have all of my data and mine all my stuff and show me ads and I'll click on things that you tell me to if I can have, you know, Gmail or if I can have Facebook. And that's I think, just becoming a more conscientious choice. I think it's wrong to try to demonize Facebook, frankly, because as if their privacy policy is our only protection, you know, in terms of our ability to have privacy on social media. That's something that we're empowered with and that we regularly, you know, trade in exchange for functionality.
But I really think a lot of people don't realize it. I mean, my mother-in-law, I think
10 seconds, Kathy.
Older people don't have the same views that we have about what's actually going out there.
It's Friday. We're in the break room with Kalina Bowler, Kathy Lohr, Hector Fernandez, and Ed Sohn. It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. This is On Second Thought. We're having coffee and conversation in the break room, as we do each Friday, talking about the week's news. My guests today are Kalina Bowler, host of the Credits podcast, Kathy Lohr, journalist and former NPR correspondent covering the Southeast out of Atlanta, Hector Fernandez, professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at Georgia State University, and also Ed Sohn, vice president and product management at Thomson Reuters Legal. A lot of people's worst fears about self-driving cars came true this past weekend. Here CNBC reports.
Uber autonomous vehicle was driving about 40 miles per hour when it struck a pedestrian, 49-year-old woman Elaine Herzberg, on Sunday night. A safety driver was behind the wheel, but the vehicle, a Volvo SUV, was traveling in autonomous mode at the time.
That's right. A self-driving Uber car struck and killed a woman walking her bike on the side of the road in Arizona. Arizona is participating in a pilot program for autonomous vehicles. In Georgia, Governor Deal signed a law last year paving the way for self-driving cars right here. Should we think twice, Hector?
I think so. I mean, this is technology that's going to come sooner or later, but we need to embrace it more guardedly. The nerds are really good at embracing the physical, logical possibilities, thinking about them, imagining them, programming them. But they need to account for people's foolishness. I mean, this lady, I watched the video, and she walked right in front of the car. Then again, the car has to be intelligent enough to, you know, prevent this sort of situations.
Or at least slow it down. I mean, from the video, which, of course, we're not seeing, but, I mean, it doesn't look like there was any attempt for the car to stop itself. And then it also, the safety driver in the vehicle was like completely blown away and was like, what happened? You know, it looked like the expression. So I'm like, what was the safety driver doing and what are their responsibilities as well?
Good question, Kathy. But I suppose, Kalina, the question in my mind is, autonomous vehicle struck and killed a pedestrian. You know what other kind of vehicle strikes and kills pedestrians all the time?
Other cars, people
other
behind cars.
Driven by humans,
yeah, absolutely.
Right? And the question is, which is going to be more or less hazardous? And I guess the question to that question is, who wants to participate in the study to find out?
I think all of us are going to be unwilling participants in these kinds of studies. It's the wave of the future. It's going to happen. And if it's not, it may not necessarily happen first on a smaller scale, like, you know, just have SUVs riding around where people have them for private use. We may see more large trucks transporting goods on highways, things like that. And even in those instances, there will be live drivers behind the wheels of their own cars next to these autonomous trucks. So, yeah, we do have to absolutely improve the technology. But unfortunately, we may see more of this, maybe not someone dying in the process, but someone possibly being hurt, because that's how, unfortunately, that's how we learn. It's sadly sometimes part of the scientific method in a way.
Yeah, you know, just a real quick policy rundown on this, though. I mean, first of all, they say that, Hector, to your point, it's not yet perfected. The technology's not 100% there. But if we were to start implementing it earlier, we'd start saving tens of thousands of lives a year earlier. Right. The longer that we delay that kind of like letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. But the other piece of it is that, you know, a company like Tesla or Uber is a lot more exposed to liability than a person behind a car. And so even if the overall instance decreases, the sort of like liability and the exposure and the deep pockets in litigation increases. And then the last thing is unintended consequences happen all the time. I was reading an article about how if all these lives are saved through autonomous cars, other lives will be at risk because of the dramatic decrease in organ donations. So, like, the entire system as sort of a dynamic system.
Yeah, wow, good points. Let's go back to the topic of social media networks behaving badly. Facebook was not the only offender this week. Snapchat came under fire after an ad on the Snapchat app asked whether users would rather slap Rihanna or punch Chris Brown. This was a joking, or I should say, quote unquote, joking reference to that celebrity couple's well-documented history of domestic violence. Hardy har har har. Snapchat stock lost $800 million. Does that feel like appropriate justice, Kalina?
Absolutely. I actually laughed the other day. My husband pulled out his phone to get a little Snapchat of my two-year-old nephew. And while the filter of him being a bunny rabbit was cute, I said, you may be the only person on Snapchat right now, because it's just now taboo in the world of social media right now. Like, you cannot make these kinds of jokes, especially with the major topics that are out there today and around domestic violence, bullying, what have you. And it was just in poor taste. So absolutely, they should have been losing money. And I'm happy to see at least some sort of justice served in this regard.
But then again, this is a third-party app that did this, the Would You Rather app. Can we really hold Snapchat accountable for everything that every app maker does on their platform, Kathy?
Yes. Who is reviewing these ads? I'm sorry. I know that. Who is supposed to review these ads? They said, oh, it got through accidentally or whatever. We didn't know. But so, you know, the buck's got to stop somewhere. Somebody has to look at this and say, this is a ridiculous ad, this is not appropriate, and we're not going to put it on our site.
I disagree, honestly, because you cannot review every ad that goes onto a platform. You've created sort of like a literal platform on which anyone can build anything.
Then get out of the business, because it's your platform. You have to be responsible for what you're running in your platform. I mean, you cannot be
especially
with
in
the same
age.
Attitude as the banks. I'm too big to fail.
But millions of ads going up there. I mean, it's literally impossible. I mean, you couldn't hire enough people to lay eyes on all the ads.
Then you're going to have less apps, and then that's the point.
Well, I mean, they're going to fail then if they continue to do.
Well, here's the thing. I don't know if Snapchat is necessarily failing, because yes, it may be down right now, But, you know, our attention spans are short. You know what I mean?
And, and by the way, Kylie Jenner made Snapchat go down by more than $1 billion just by saying, I don't like it. It's dead. And then, like, so, like, I think that's an interest. It's a really interesting phenomenon. You said that that's an appropriate punishment. It's a very interesting phenomenon that the market would actually punish the value of the stock based on what they perceive to be potential bad PR for these social networks. It's an interesting sort of it's an interesting thing that's playing out.
Yeah. And then the punishment is short lived, though, to be
in
honest.
Most cases. Yeah. We don't know. We'll see.
Speaking, Ed, of the Kardashian clan, as you did. And in general, all persons famous for their famousness. Kim Kardashian came roaring back into the headlines when she offered a rather limited choice for dark-skinned women as part of her new makeup line. More choices for light-skinned women, fewer choices for dark-skinned women like herself. Honest mistake or just going for publicity as she's always is? Anybody have thoughts?
I mean, I would be curious, honestly, as to how many other makeup lines really have, like, offer sufficient options for dark-skinned people. It just feels like, I'm not trying to let Kim off the hook here. I mean, I think it's a very, like, I'm really glad that it's being brought to the surface and in the conversation. I'm just curious to know, like, how blatant that was.
Well, this is a historic problem in beauty lines. It's been an ongoing issue for a couple of decades where it's been pretty clear that there's not enough shades. So if you're starting a new line and you're supposed to be inclusive, well, then why wouldn't you include more shades?
But those are the French. This is a Kardashian. This is an ad stunt. I mean, the woman is married to Kanye West. So she knows what she's doing. That said, it's her business. She's allowed to do whatever she wants with her business. If she wants to run it into the ground, so be it. I don't think it's going to happen, but I mean, it's her business. The people can't tell her how to run her business. I think it's an ad stunt. I think it's just, as a couple, they're really good at selling.
I think the Kardashian-Jenners are having some sort of a marketing issue. I mean, which one was it? Kylie or I don't remember who had the horrible snafu with Pepsi.
Yeah.
And now
Kendall.
Right. Yeah, thank you, Kendall. Whatever. And then of course Kim with not having the shades for darker skinned people. I think they try to go after what they perceive to be their core audience, and maybe they feel like they skew on the lighter hue side. I don't know. I can't even pretend to know. I just I'm Fenty Beauty all the way, it's all good.
What's really funny, though, really quick, though, is if you look at the ad, it is almost absurd because it is a dark-skinned person with, like, 16 shades of concealer.
Yes. It's a dark-skinned model.
None of those concealers match your skin.
That's why, and then that's why people were upset, because why are you
It's intentional. Let's use a dark-skinned model to show the fact that we have shades that lack a dark-skinned shade, right? I mean, so it's intentional.
Like, who is in their camp over there that's okaying all of this?
Here we go. Exactly.
Right.
Like, what are these marketing geniuses doing, right?
You know.
Same people watching Snapchat's ads.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, exactly.
There it is.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the week's news in the break room here. It's Friday on Second Thought. I've never found a good way to say that, on Second Thought. I'm just going to say it's Friday on Second Thought. We're with Kalina Bowler, Kathy Lohr, Hector Fernandez, and Ed Sohn talking about the week's news. Lionel Richie stood up for his American Idol colleague Katy Perry, but a whole lot of folks are shading her for kissing a 19-year-old male contestant on the program who had never been kissed. Here is that moment as it played out on the show.
Have you kissed a girl and liked it?
No, I've never been in a relationship.
Really?
I can't kiss a girl without being in a relationship.
Come here, buddy.
Come here.
Come here right now.
So you got a young man there saying, no, please don't kiss me. And Katy Perry kissed him. And so I think that if the sexes had been reversed, we all know that this would be playing out very differently. But is that the right metric to apply to this when we're deciding about how bad it was? Anybody have any thoughts?
Look, regardless, this is puritanism gone haywire. This run amok. This is ridiculous. I mean, she barely kissed him for a second. I mean, and the guy has the age. And he later came out saying that he was pleased by it. It was okay by him. If it's okay by him, nobody else should be talking about it. It's his business.
If it was not okay by him at the time, then actually it's technically battery.
That's what I'm saying. I'm like, this is horrible.
It's an offensive touching. Honestly, yeah.
Irresponsible and unwise. She was trying to make a joke.
That's not a joke, guys.
No, I think it was a joke. But
she may have thought it was, but we all know, as Adam just said, we all know if the roles were reversed, we would have been clutching
our pearls. It was a very mild kiss in public in television.
It doesn't matter. He didn't want it.
It's like, it was a very mild grope of that woman.
It doesn't matter what the gender is, who's perpetrating what. He didn't want it at the time. And he may have, yes, and you're right, he may have come out later and said, you know what, I thought about it, it was fine, that's okay. But in the moment, absolutely not. That is not
well,
cool.
I think he was shocked.
My son, I'd be highly upset.
His initial response was, oh no, please, hold on. Like, that's
that's what I mean.
I'm saving myself for
this. This is ridiculous. I mean,
no means no.
One thing is that Donald...
Let Kathy speak.
That's okay. It's okay. I'm just thinking later he said, look, thank you, Katy Perry, for launching my career. And he said, I wasn't sexually harassed. He put that
again,
out.
Right. And he said it later, and that's okay. But at the time, guys...
Well, no. I think it was not a wise move, but I don't think it's to the extreme of... the sexual harassment. I mean, yeah, I think we have kind of gone off.
I mean,
there's
got to be practical boundaries to the whole.
No means no. Literally, we're drawing the line.
If you're on
here.
Campus and you have a woman, and the woman is in a party, and she has an 800-pound gorilla next to her, and he's totally drunk. I mean, do you think it's realistic to tell the woman, you know, you can say no means no, and he's going to get it? No, he's not going to get it. You're setting her up for failure. I don't think that's responsible. I mean, when you take things to extremes, that's puritanism gone amok.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. That was a good response.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's all right. No. It's all right. Well done. We'll go ahead and try to sneak in one more topic. Something else on the celebrity beat. Music moguls Diddy and Jay-Z have created an app allowing you to pinpoint black businesses within any area that you're trying to obtain products or services. What do we think of that? I suppose I should note that this has already been done. There is an app called Official Black Wall Street, which does the exact same thing. It just wasn't started by celebrities. But nonetheless, is this a good thing to have multiple players in the marketplace?
Yeah, sure. Why not? I mean, like you said, it's already been done. I want to say like maybe 2 or 3 years ago, it's already been done. And there are other people who don't have such a large platform or large celebrity behind it who have created similar apps in their particular locale. So I'm over it. Whatever.
I think it's a great idea. I don't think it's controversial.
Controversial. Yeah. Yeah. It's fine.
I tend to agree. I mean, there's already sort of ways and ways to market or kind of promote minority-owned businesses, mm-hmm. women-owned businesses. You can, if you're shopping for a date, you can go into a million different kind of dating apps that kind of are tailored exactly to, you know, the people that you want to interact with. I think it's completely fine.
I think it's a very ingenious idea, but I think it's culturally limiting. It feels a little bit to me like economic ghettoism. I mean, I don't think all the things that I like to consume come from a single ethnicity. In fact, I know they don't because I thrive on difference. And I don't think I would like to be willing to live my life, you know, for the sake of economic efficiency, supporting a particular group to avoid consuming from any other group.
But I don't think that's what they're doing. They're not saying that they're going to avoid consuming from from non-minority or non-black businesses.
Yeah, it's never been that.
That's the direction in which they're heading.
Well, that's not what they're saying.
That's the direction in which they're heading.
Okay. I'll disagree.
Are you coming from, Hector, are you coming from a place of, you know, multiculturalism is obviously a good thing and
yes.
We need to start doing that? Of course, I hear you on that. But what I believe these apps are trying to do is inform people more so than say you must buy from this black vendor here or this black shop here. I think you're trying to inform people who would like to have more choice than big box.
Well, it's capitalism, a capitalist activism combined with a certain sense of ethnic solidarity. And eventually that goes into a direction that I just don't think it's practical.
It doesn't need to be ethnic solidarity because I could use that app. And not black people can use that app. And I think that's...
I was going to say...
I mean, that's multicultural.
And I
right
can
there.
Use that app.
Do you need an app to realize who you want to sponsor or patronize?
Sometimes you do.
I think it's evident.
Not really. Like, for instance, if I was invited to somebody's Passover Seder and I wanted to, you know, bring something literally to the table. And I said, you know what? If there was an app where I could find local Jewish businesses that I could, you know, sure. patronize, I would love that. Personally, I would love that. And then after a while, I wouldn't necessarily have to use the app all the time. You know what I mean? I think it's more of a tool for finding out more about
this is not the, Jewish
you.
Community doing this. This is not the Jewish community doing this. This
what
are
if it
two,
was?
Two,
I mean,
two very prominent.
Oh boy. Okay, we are getting into territory. We are getting into territory now that will sufficiently exceed the 25 seconds we have left in the program. So we'll have to leave it there. Out of time on The Break Room today. Thanks to my guests, Kalina Bowler of the Credits Podcast, former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr, Georgia State Professor Hector Fernandez, and Ed Sohn of Thomson Reuters Legal. Thank you all. Have a good weekend.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Same thing. Bye-bye.
It's on Second Thought.